Hello and welcome to this episode of Superhero Ethics. Today we're talking about kids' movies. Kids' movies? That's kind of the idea. We're going to be talking about Luca, Raya and the Last Dragon, and just the idea of what does it mean to be a kids' movie and what can we learn from them? All that and more after a commercial break we have no control over. Welcome back. My name is Matthew. I'm your host. I'm joined by a special guest, Paul Hoppe. Paul, how are we doing tonight?
Medium. You know, I'm like physically, I went to the doctor the first time in a couple years because, you know, the ongoing pandemic and whatnot. And I got a tetanus shot because they're like, hey, do you want a tetanus shot? And I was like, sure, I'll get a tetanus shot. And it's a little painful. Like mentally and emotionally, I'm like two thumbs up. So, you know.
Awesome.
Kind of
good here.
Some
good
column
here.
A, some column B. How are you?
I'm dealing with a bit of a rough throat at the moment. I'll hopefully keep most of my throat clearing edited out, but I apologize if a little bit sneaks through, or to those here on Twitch. We are once again recording live on Twitch, so if people have questions or comments or feedback or thoughts or anything at all, please just kind of jump right in the chat, and we'll get to it either in the moment or definitely before we wrap up. So, well, let's kind of just jump right into this topic, because what we're talking about today is, it's kind of two things. I'll kind of give the evolution of how we came to this topic. Paul, you had been really excited about the movie Raya and the Last Dragon. And I finally got around to watching that. And then I had you told me that Luca was very good, or did I talk to you about Luca, or did we just both watch it independently?
So I watched Luca, and I was like, hey, have you seen Luca? And you were like, no. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and I might have been like, put it on the list. I think you might have said you were going to, so I just didn't really say much about it. But I had watched it when it came out. Lee wanted to watch. She always wants to watch the animated movies, basically.
Right.
And I don't know. I enjoy animation at least as much as live action, possibly more a lot of the time. So.
Yeah, it is something that I have definitely grown a lot on, in part due to your influence. And that's kind of what we want to get into today, because I was one of those people who always saw animation as kind of a kid's thing. Mm. And it also just is not my brain is not very visual. And so I often prefer things just being straightforward, like people on screen. But I remember talking to you, you got me into shows like Batman, the Animated Series and Clone Wars and stuff like that. And I think both of those are, and then Avatar, The Last Airbender. All of which I think people think of as kids' shows.
Right.
And in some ways that's true. I think certainly like they're all shows that I think most parents would have no problem showing their kids.
Right.
Some Batman the Animated Series maybe a little not for like the youngest of kids, but mostly they're family-friendly entertainment. But like, you know, I remember you and I had a lot of great conversations, especially about Avatar, but about all of them, about why is there this sort of thinking that like, entertainment that is family friendly, make it sound like it's, you know, Christian and conservative. That's not what I mean at all. But, you know, that is aimed for all audiences. That means it's not serious. So that means it can't be as good. And so we were talking about like, okay, do we want to do an episode on Raya and the Last Dragon? Do we want to do an episode on Luca? Do we want to do one on each? And I think there's a lot of themes that came up between the two of them. But for me, I mean, more than anything, the biggest theme was how these are two of the best movies I've seen this year, I think. Maybe the two best I've seen this year. And that both of them just have so much to say about the kind of questions we're talking about in ways that I think a lot of people think kids' movies wouldn't. And so that's kind of where I wanted to start today. We're going to talk about each of those movies individually. I will say we'll be spoiling some of the movies, but also if you haven't seen them, but you're not worried about spoilers, we'll kind of fill you in enough on the plot to follow our discussion. But we're going to be kind of talking about them in a more general way. Although they are both great, so if you do want to hit pause, watch them, come back, please go ahead and do so. But Paul, let's just kind of start with a general idea. Like, what do you think of when people talk about, like, these movies as kids' movies?
Yeah, I mean, the first thought is, like, it feels kind of ageist, you know? The idea that, like, there are certain themes or concepts that are for certain people of a certain age, and certain ones that are not for people, like, if something's suitable for children, that then it shouldn't be suitable for adults. I mean, I also personally push back on the idea that a lot of things that people think are not suitable for children, I mean, if I had a child, I'd be like, yeah, just watch whatever. And like, we'll see how you feel about it. And then if you have negative reactions to certain things, we'll like try and, you know, help you kind of avoid that to some extent. But like, you know, I mean, I could go off on certain things that I saw at certain ages, but like, I feel like I saw a lot of stuff at a young age, and I don't feel like it affected me negatively. If anything, I feel like it affected me positively. Similarly, though, or like the opposite of that is, I think there's this idea that like if something doesn't have a lot of like sex and violence in it or cursing or not that I have a problem with things having some of those, but like if it doesn't have really heavy stakes or isn't always like very serious about its stakes, that like it's for kids. And I'd say one thing is often like the age of the protagonist, sort of, you know, like protagonists will often be aged around the target audience or like a couple years older. And so, you know, if you look at like Avatar The Last Airbender, the protagonists are pretty young. If you look at a lot of superhero fiction, one of the reasons they added sidekicks, I think, was so that younger people would have someone that maybe they'd relate to more. You know, there's some movies like Let the Right One In, which is a Swedish horror film with child protagonists. Like, I wouldn't say that's a kid's movie, you know?
The Professional is one of my favorite movies, and possibly Natalie Portman's best performance while she was maybe 10.
13,
not something I'd advise like 4-year-old watching.
But for the most part, I think problem with a 4-year-old watching it, but I understand what you're saying. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Not a kid's movie.
I think that's a really good way to start it and to talk about it, because I do I have very similar ideas on this. I did a podcast on this. I did an episode on this podcast a while ago, specifically on parenting. I'll say I'm not a parent. I really like the approach that my guest had on that, where he talked about that he thinks of his three things, that the only thing he doesn't want his kids to watch is stuff where like he thinks it might cause nightmares or be upsetting in that kind of a way. And I think that's understandable. Sure. And it's very much dependent on kids. And I'm going to kind of let the child psychologist talk about that. Then there's a lot of stuff where it's like, yeah, kids should be able, it's okay to see like, you know, nudity or, you know, sexuality or like low levels of violence or whatever. And then a lot of stuff that, as he put it, like he would only want his kids to watch critically.
Right.
Like, you know, he would want to watch and be able to talk to him about like, okay, well, what are the messages this has about like, you know, like if you watch Fast and Furious and all of the, you know, his daughters are seeing all the girls in bikinis. Let's maybe talk about that, you know?
Right.
And I don't want to get too much into that. It's a great episode. But I think I very much I'm with you in that same regard of like, I think the stuff that we think of as like, oh, kids shouldn't watch that, especially in the United States. My mother was, I've talked to this before, but you know, she was like, see all the naked bodies you want, but she didn't ever want me to watch violence on television.
Right.
Which put her totally at odds with most other mothers. Yeah. That's all kind of a long tangent
to
the main point that we're talking about. But you brought it up, and it's really one I wanted to dive into. But I think the kind of main point we're getting here at, that I really like how you described, is I love dark and gritty. You know, I loved The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, because it made those things feel so much more real and intense.
Sure,
and I think there's a greatness to that, but I think that sometimes, I think our focus on that has absolutely done what you're talking about, that there's a sense of like, well, if no one dies, it doesn't mean anything, you know, or if the people aren't cursing or having these kind of hard emotions.
Yeah.
And part of why I was so moved by these two movies is that they deal with some very sensitive issues, very difficult issues. There's like people die in very intense ways. Like there's a lot going on, and yet they're able, like they do it in ways that are not, you know, no one's, I think, going to feel, even though, you know, depending on however I might feel about other people's opinions of what their kids should or shouldn't watch, these are clearly like family friendly in that kind of a way.
Right. They're aimed that way. They're marketed that way.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Dark Knight and Batman Begins are these like gritty, dark movies, but like they're also about a dude who dresses up like a bat and, you know, has like all these wonderful toys, you know, and like, I love Batman. But like, oh, is that not on the thing? Yeah. Anyway,
I wore
a Batman t-shirt. But like it, you know, I mean, it's not even just like superhero films, like any film. It's like, it's adults pretending that there's someone else. Like there's something kind of inherently not like super serious about the whole thing in terms of drama.
Yeah.
And so I think it's fine, like when we're watching something, like take it seriously, take it however seriously you want. I'm not criticizing that, but like then being like, oh, this is serious and this isn't serious, it's like, you know, stories are stories, and you know, themes and visuals don't belong to any one age group. And I do think that, you know, Raya and Luca both are designed to try to be suitable for wide audiences. Yet they have some themes that I think are what people, you know, some people might kind of want to keep their kids away from those themes.
Right.
In terms of, you know, I guess, you know, what you were referring to earlier.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and you kind of put the cards on the table for those who haven't seen them. I think Luca especially. Luca is a very sweet movie about, you know, kids and sea monsters. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, it's a very kind of, like, classic animated show for kids about, you know, learning tolerance and learning to accept and learning to get past fear. It's also an incredibly clear allegory for the process for about like coming out as being young and queer,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to me, it's so great for that because of the way it can, you can be 6 years old and watch it and have no understanding of that allegory. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But I know lots of parents who've talked about how either A, they already have, or they're planning to in a couple of years, like when they do, when topics of like homosexuality or stuff mm-hmm. like that, or especially the idea that like, this kid in my school didn't talk about it for a while. Why, you know, using this movie as a way to like plant the seeds of understanding like what that whole process is about and what it means to be something that shouldn't be judged with other people around you might be judged.
Yeah. And I think that's like a really important lesson that you can learn when you're six and then carry it forward when it becomes more specifically relevant, you know, or when it may become more specifically relevant.
You know, and I think one of the biggest ideas of this podcast has always been that the media we love is the stuff that makes us ask questions, mm-hmm. you know, not just about like, oh yeah, why did Tony Stark do that? But like, what is Tony Stark doing that? What can that tell us about our own world? You know? And I think kids movies, quote unquote, like there is certainly the whole like ABC school after special, ABC after school special that's hitting you over the head with a point so hard that it's just awful entertainment.
Yes.
I think these two movies, as well as stuff like Avatar and Batman the Animated Series, what they do so well is to, you know, make people of all ages want to ask these questions. And like, I actually did a lot of digging on this. And with both of them, there's so many tweets and posts and things like that and TikToks about parents saying like the great questions their kids asked, you know, as well as adults ask them. And so, yeah, to me, that's just like, it's. We have some critiques about these movies. It's not just going to be a total shine fest, for sure. But I think both these movies should remind me why this kind of thing is so important and why, like, it can be a kid's movie that does these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like you can just reach more people if you're creating media that people are going to be receptive to, you know?
Right.
And, of course, there's ways you can go deeper on different issues through other media. But
yeah.
I do think that both of these created a... It's like... you know, with reference to after school specials, to me, it's like, if you're not telling a good story, then having a powerful allegory or some moral to the story, it's not going to reach people because people aren't going to like your story and aren't going to connect with it. When you tell a story that's a great story and you tell it artfully, people are going to connect with that. It's going to resonate with people. And then your message is going to get through. And if you're just like message, and like trying to hit people over the head with it, I don't think it's going to be as effective as if you like effortlessly weave it through. And I'm making a lot of hand gestures here. So you should come on Twitch next time if you're listening to the podcast.
Come check this out for sure. One other thing I think that can be a really important part of like, because I'm using a term like, instead of kids movies, like family friendly or like all, you know, all ages friendly. Because I do think there is entertainment that I wouldn't describe as kids movies. I describe it as juvenile.
Sure.
You know, and maybe this is like, there's a lot of stuff that like people of all ages love and I'm glad you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like to me, like the Trolls movie is what I would describe as more juvenile, not all ages friendly. But then I'd call half of Adam Sandler's movies juvenile.
Yeah,
I mean, that can apply to anything.
Sure,
you know?
For sure.
One of my favorite things also that I think that can be really brilliant when these kind of movies do or TV shows do, and I didn't see this as much with these two, but like one of my favorite examples of all this is The Muppet Show.
Mm.
Because what I'm talking about here is where you can have humor on a lot of different levels.
Right.
As an 8-year-old, I loved The Muppet Show because like, you know, things were blowing up and Fozzie was getting things thrown at him and there was a frog and a pig. And it was just fun.
Yeah.
And I remember being surprised at how much my parents loved it.
Mm.
And then I go back and watch it as an adult and I'm like, oh, that's a parody of Howard Cosell. Oh, that's like biting satire of something going on.
Right.
Like, oh, that's like, there's so much layers there. But what Jim Henson and The Rem were so good at was like putting that in a way that like kids weren't sitting there going like, wait, what's this about? You know,
right.
it to me, that's a different kind of example of, but one where like you can have humor that's aimed at all different levels in the same show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the same way you can have some heavy things and some light things in the same show, right, or the same movie. I also, I loved The Muppets as a kid. I never really rewatched it, so I didn't have that experience you had. I watched it with my parents, who I believe also enjoyed it. You know, I do think things having kind of multiple levels, you know. I think one of these had like a number of like fart jokes in them that I was like, okay, you know. And I'm like, I can do without that. But like at the same time, it's like, whatever. It's a passing thing.
Yeah.
It can hit on multiple levels.
Okay. Stop making fart jokes in the podcast now. So just because I know it's one of your favorites, and we're going to dive into these two specifically, but talk for a minute about why for you Avatar: The Last Airbender is such a good example of like what the kind of thing we're talking about.
Okay. Actually, if you want to start talking about Raya, my first like 8 points are how it reminds me of Avatar: The Last Airbender.
That's fine.
I'll use that as a bit of a transition.
Sure.
Which, I mean, I absolutely loved Raya. I think it's my favorite Disney movie that I've ever seen. Part of it is like it doesn't have the songs, and I know the songs are the attraction for some people. They're not for me. So, you know. But it also like, I mean, I know, like, she kind of looks like Korra at times in terms of, like, her outfit and stuff and age and, and you know, gender. But the overall show just feels very Airbender to me. Like, things I loved about Airbender that then also were present in Raya is, you know, the main character has an animal companion who they're legitimately close with and has a personality that, like, I, as a viewer, care about. Not just because I'm like, oh, they're cute. But it's like, they're a person, you know,
right?
Who then also is involved in the shenanigans, you know? So I really enjoy that in both. That one's actually more about how it's better than the Last Airbender. but similar to the Last Airbender, both of them they're not a direct representation of a culture. They're both like fantasy settings that draw inspiration from many related cultures. Like, The Last Airbender is, I'd say, most heavily kind of Chinese influenced, but there's also Japanese and Korean and other, and probably, I imagine, Southeast Asian and East Asian influences. And that, at the time, like, I think that was very uncommon in TV shows, you know, and for the first series especially, I think they were very diligent about, like, they had somebody who was consulting on it, who also did all the calligraphy, which is beautiful, and is, like, era appropriate. Like, there's different eras and different types of styles of calligraphy, and you know it, and then Raya is more like Southeast Asian cultures, but it's a fantasy setting, right? So it's not like this is supposed to be historically accurate, and I think that can be powerful sort of in terms of inclusion, in terms of exposing more people to more cultures, and also just like, I don't know, like, this is kind of maybe a long tangent, which I won't go on a long tangent, but just, like, I've always had sort of an affinity for a lot of aspects of Asian culture, which to me is different from, like, fetishizing. Just in terms of feeling, like, I haven't worn my shoes in the house for decades, like, just because I'm like, oh yeah, that just makes sense to me, you know?
Right.
And so in terms of, like, resonating with me, that kind of has an effect. Also, the martial arts are awesome. I'm looking forward to listening to the Animation Deliberation podcast with Scotty St. Clair and Zuhair Ali and his martial arts instructor, who I think teaches Filipino martial arts. They're going to do an episode on Raya, the Last Dragon, with the martial arts instructor, talking about a lot of the influences. And, you know, Avatar: The Last Airbender had, like, they had a real martial artist, like, talking about, like, how, you know, all of the bending styles were based on actual martial arts, right? And actual movements. Right. And so it felt very real. And, you know, the animation's also just beautiful. And there's this mix, this very rare mix of humor, like lightheartedness and weight, like the gravity of the situation, right? In Avatar: The Last Airbender, like, the title character is literally the last airbender, because the rest of the airbenders got genocided. Like, that's some heavy shit, right? Like, and at the same time, he goes through that and feels that, and you feel that and that pain And, you know, suffering throughout the world, because it's not just them who got genocided, but then there's also, you know, the Fire Nation is at war with all the others. But there's also this weight, and that character maintains that weight as well. Here, I think Raya doesn't kind of have that weight. I think more when she finds the last dragon, spoilers, there's Awkwafina kind of brings that sort of uplifting, sort of like lightness, but the movie carries that. I think it has a spirit of like levity as well as gravity. And I just think that's a very rare combination, and I just loved it.
Yeah, it's fun. I really like the movie too. I had one kind of complaint, and it's about one of the ethical questions we'll get into, but for the most part, I really liked the movie. And it reminded me in some way, like, and it's kind of a similar topic we'll get into with both of these movies, that tropes are not always bad things. Mm-hmm. Especially, like, I maybe even want to find a better word than trope. Like, because what I'm talking about is the idea of, like, the Disney princess movie.
Right.
Like, a Disney princess movie is by now a fairly set formula, which, and like, it's funny you talked about it, like, one of the defining aspects of a Disney princess movie is the animal companion who doesn't necessarily speak English, but our heroine talks to and does most of her, like, exposition at,
right,
and clearly communicates back and forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it does, like, oh, why can't I remember the name of the little dragon in Mulan? You know, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But, you know, but that's a very common part of it. To me, like, the songs are a common part. The martial arts scenes, not so much.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, they can... But what I think Disney has started doing a lot more of recently is saying anyone can be a Disney princess. And so let's take a Disney princess story and set it in New Orleans Black cuisine culture or in, you know, China or in here, you know, the fantasy world of the folklore of Vietnam and Southeast Asia. And I mean, I'm not Vietnamese, I'm not Southeast Asian. To me, it was a fascinating rendition of that kind of stuff. My understanding is I've heard a lot of people very positive about it, some people being kind of critical about it, that they didn't do things as well as they could have. I can't comment on that. But certainly it exposed me to a lot of these things that I might not have known as much about, made me want to curious and want to know more. And I think there's something great about saying, let's just take a basic story that you've heard 100 times, because Raya is many things. It is not a surprising movie. Like, very quickly from the beginning of the movie, you know everything that's going to happen. But it never felt boring, because it felt like, you know, it was like saying, like, okay, you know, West Side Story doesn't surprise you at all, because it is Romeo and Juliet. You've seen that story 1,000 times. But it's saying, let's take Romeo and Juliet and set it in 1950s, you know, gang New York.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what this was doing. It's saying, like, okay, you know the story of a Disney princess, but let's take it in this totally different setting and see how that changes the story and how it affects it. And that alone, I just think, is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about criticisms of the cultural representation, again, I can't comment too deeply on that. I do think a Disney movie is not going to be the best representation of any given culture.
Yeah.
And here, again, it is, I think, trying to convey influences from a variety of cultures rather than... from one culture. And then also, it's like, you know, you can talk about, like, well, but if it's for profit by this big Western company, Disney, okay, there's a whole thing there, right?
Yeah.
Granted. I do think that things like the fact that these dragons are more creatures of the water, which is traditionally more accurate from my understanding in terms of, like, Asian dragons as opposed to Western dragons. I appreciate that. I think, you know, the fact that it's voiced almost entirely by actors of Asian descent, that's something that The Last Airbender could have done a lot better, right?
Yeah.
They really only had a couple throughout. You know, that was 15 years ago, and it's like, 15 years later, it's like, do better. It's like, okay, you're doing better. You know, I know there's some people who felt like the fact that at least half or maybe more than half were, like, East Asian rather than Southeast Asian. You know, there's a whole thing there. Personally, like, I feel like getting too granular in terms of certain types of representation when you're, like, drawing from multiple groups of people who have been, you know, oppressed or have had less opportunity. I kind of like the tact that a show like Warrior, very much not a kid's show, you know, does in terms of most of the characters are Chinese, but they aren't only casting, like, you know, Chinese American or Chinese Canadian. But again, that's, like, that's the sort of thing that, like, whatever your opinion is, like, you know, I respect that. Like, your feelings are your feelings. And I'm not going to say something is right or isn't. I do think Kelly Marie Tran and Gemma Chan both were great. They play kind of the two principal, you know, protagonist and antagonist. Their dynamic is particularly impressive, given that they weren't even recording together.
Yeah, because everything was being done during pandemic time.
Exactly.
And like the first thing you said, again, I don't think we can get into it much. Mm-hmm. I don't really feel like I can even go as far as what you're saying in terms of saying like that I have kind of a preference one or the other, mm-hmm. because I just think I'm not of one of those cultures, and so sure. I just don't really have an opinion there. But I think you're right. It's like for these tropes are things we're constantly getting better at. We're constantly learning. This may not have been perfect yet. It's certainly much better than what Avatar: The Last Airbender did, which is both of them much better than the Avatar movie, which, cast white actors except for the bad guys.
Well, here's the thing. Like, the Avatar movie actually hired more people of Asian descent than the series.
Did they?
Not in main roles, but, it did. Like, tons of extras and a lot of characters, whereas there were, basically two main characters in the original voice bit, fair. So I feel like it's more like a criticism of the series that we have to see the movie and be like, hey, you should have done better. I'm not sticking up for the movie.
Yeah, let's not that get into the, I mean, there's also a whole bunch of thing about what races or what color and stuff in terms of the good guys versus bad guys. But anyway,
there's a lot there.
But the other thing I was gonna say is also in the same way, this version of the Disney princess trope mm-hmm. is also kind of unrecognizable because she's not sitting around sighing waiting for a prince to rescue her.
Right.
You know, the Disney princess trope is also one that has had a lot of problems. It still isn't perfect. But one thing that I've loved is seeing all these stories from parents who talking about not just their daughters, their sons being Raya's awesome. I want to be Raya for Halloween, you know? And that's great mm-hmm. to have young boys. Same kind of thing that happened with Frozen and stuff like that. So let's get into some of the actual issues that Raya brings up, and then we'll get to Luca in a bit. The first thing I'll give kind of... You want to give a 60-second plot summary?
Okay.
That I gave you no preparation time for whatsoever?
Yeah, 60-second plot summary. No problem. Basically, there's some dark spirits or whatever that feed on, distrust and whatever, called the Drone, and they turn people into stone. And then the dragons were like, hey, let's stop them. So they made a big egg or something. And it stopped them. But then the dragons were all stone. And still tons of people were stone. And then one of the five... are they tribes? I'm trying to remember. I think... Are they tribes?
Five nations within this one land.
Right. So the
and
five...
And it used to all be the one land of Kunlandia.
Kumandra, right?
Kumandra, thank you.
So they all... they basically... The one king, place Heart has the gem that's supposed to keep away, the Drune. And then this one, I want to get her name right. Namari comes in with her, Benja is a tribe chief, right?
Yeah.
Or king.
I think this is not going to work as a summary in 2 seconds. There's just too much going on.
There's a lot going on. Basically, the gem gets shattered. It's kind of Raya's fault, but kind of not. And then she goes to collect all the rest of them. She wakes up the last dragon. And they keep just adding members to the gang, which is also very Avatar The Last Airbender, where they're kind of just collecting people over time. And people from each... from the Fire Nation and the Water Nation. Wait, no, that's not it. and brings them all together, and then everybody lives happily ever after. Maybe.
Yeah, and there's a couple of instances. One of the key moments along the way is that all this has happened because people don't trust each other, because some people have resources, mm-hmm. others don't, and that during this time of them all not knowing each other, all of these ideas spring up about all of those people are this and all these people are that. And that there comes to be a moment when once again, they have to work together, but they don't trust each other. And in kind of there always has to be a moment where our hero does the right thing that shows their growth, that fixes everything. And it's Raya trusting this person who's betrayed her before and saying look, I'll put my knife down first so that we can work together and that kind of thing. And it's a very nice story, although that one part especially I have some questions about that we'll get into. But to me, I think one of the first things I wanted to get into about the movie was it feels like one of the real themes is about the difference between the stories what happens when the stories you've been told don't match with the reality that you experience. Because, and it's everything from you know, Raya has always learned about the dragons as these mythical creatures of wonder and wisdom and, you know, majesty. And it's played by Awkwafina. Awkwafina doing Awkwafina things, which is being like silly and kooky and ridiculous and having fun and being smart and powerful and wise in some way, but actually in a very Avatar-like way of being like, you know, a 10-year-old kid with a lot of wisdom.
Very Aang-ish, actually.
Yeah. And so she definitely has a moment of like, oh, I think she literally says, like, you're not like the stories I heard.
Right.
And then that seems to be a theme throughout because, as you mentioned, along the way, they pick up all these, people who become part of the gang, all of whom start out as, it seems, antagonists. You know, and in each one, it's someone who one side or the other doesn't trust each other, for fair, maybe for good reason, maybe for not. But that, like, again and again, they find a way to find common ground and to realize, like, you're not the person that I was told you would be.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It does feel like the central theme is sort of, you know, about kind of like not believing the propaganda or that stories. I mean, it's very like anti-xenophobia, right? It's like you have all these groups that are all very similar, but different, but similar. And they're all just people. And if they work together, they can have a better society than if they're at odds with one another. And being at odds with one another has gotten them into quite a predicament. And, at the same time, it's like there was an actual betrayal multiple times. So sometimes, you know, sometimes there is reason not to trust someone when they've, I guess what it is like, and I can see kind of your issue with the story here, where, I favor trusting people until somebody basically gives a reason not to. And so when somebody repeatedly gives a reason not to, I think then often it's safer to be like, well, okay, you've given me a reason not to trust you, so I'm not going to keep trusting you because you've undermined that trust. And so maybe that undermines a little bit of the message of the movie.
That was kind of the main thing I was going to bring up there. And just to further explain it, basically like as a, the main antagonist, who, remind me what that character's name was?
I think it's Namari. Let me check.
Namari. She plays, she's kind of like in a similar position to Raya. She's the daughter of the leader of one of these other like groups or nations or lands. And she kind of befriends Raya early in the movie, but then it turns out that she's doing this to steal the gem, and then that's where all the fighting happens. And then for the rest of the movie, they're very much antagonists. Although very much in a, and like another theme that I'll kind of touch on in a bit, there's very much an enemies to friends to, there's some coding happening. There's very much not
there's
baiting.
There's some chemistry and tension between the characters that is not about the antagonism.
Yeah. Or you know, I mean, antagonism, the enemies to lovers is a popular story. Although again, Disney movies, not the lovers part. And we'll get to that in a second. But like, I feel like, and here is where, it's not a critique of kids' movies necessarily, but it is where I feel like the younger, I sometimes wish people who made movies like this would trust the audiences a little bit more. Because I feel like the central tension here is that, to finish the story, so we get to a point where the two of them have to trust each other, and Raya does start to trust her, but then she betrays, she like pulls out a knife, or she pulls out a crossbow, and like it's this whole thing. Yeah. And I feel like the movie got to this problem where what it showed versus what it was telling us did not match up. Because it was trying to tell us that actually this time it was Raya who didn't trust enough. And so she had to learn that kind of like they're both at fault and she has to be the one to do the thing. But I think sometimes because there's sort of like, because you still want to have the good guy seem like the good, the hero seem like the hero and everyone else not seem like the hero. It felt like they didn't want to show Raya in a bad light in any way. So it wound up seeming kind of confused. And as one person put it, who I was talking to, said, you know, this should be a great movie about learn to trust people, you know, that learn to get past your fears of them and understand they could have changed. You could see it as no matter how many times people hit you, you should trust them that they won't hit you the next time. Which is a very bad message.
That's not a good lesson.
I don't think that's the lesson. And the movie, like, book lampshades that that's not the lesson it's giving. But I did wish that they'd kind of trusted the audience a little bit more and allowed Raya to appear in a little bit more, or even her father, because the other, one of the reading I think of this could be that, like, her father's kingdom or rulership, whatever it is doing a lot better than the others. And maybe that there is some justification to why they want to share the gem instead of them all having it. And I feel like just the movie wasn't quite willing to go into, like, maybe Raya and or her father were not, like, always in the right there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he was very clearly trying to be inclusive and inviting people in and then got betrayed.
Right.
So he kind of just looks like a sucker. Whereas, you know, it if they had actually been benefiting by being the ones who had the gem, then that does add a layer to the story. I think that would be interesting. And maybe they were, and just we don't know because that story didn't tell us that, but they were doing well and they did have the gem. So, like, correlation does not, you know, imply causation, but, like, sometimes it does go together, right? I do think that, like, that Raya could have just, like, given over the other pieces of the thing and been like, here, you put it together.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think also that Namari wanted to cooperate and work together, but her mom was like, no, we're not going to do it that way. And so I feel like there was a, I didn't like that part. Like, I feel like that could have been written a little differently. And if it hadn't ended the way it did, I would hate that part. Like, that's like, you know, that's like a, that could have, like, basically ruined it for me. It was a spot where it felt like they, because, like, at that point in the movie, I kind of trusted them to sort of get through to where I wanted them to end up.
Right.
And because of that, I was able to enjoy the movie, but I was for a moment like, you better don't, you know, don't do me this way. Like, so I was relieved kind of by the end rather than,
And I mean, you know, like, your average movie, I have five of those. Don't do me like this moment. And this one, I only had one or two.
Yeah.
So, like, that alone makes it, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I think that part could have been done better. And I do think that that part, a part of that was, like, people's understanding of what they have to do to make it all ages friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wish that they didn't. Because, like, Batman the Animated Series to me, which granted, I mean, this is a movie that, like, five-year-olds can really enjoy.
Sure.
Batman the Animated Series is maybe, like, eight and up for some.
Sure.
Although, again,
I don't...
how others see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it got into a lot more kind of complex topics. But I do think that they could have trusted the audience a little bit more with that scene. But other than that, I do really love the lesson it had of, like, that when you have the cycle of mistrust and, like, trying to figure out, well, wait, but did you do it first or did I do it first? Or just someone has just got to say, I trust you now, or I'm going to give you a chance at least.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I'm going to give you a chance to not be horrible. And here's the thing, like, don't screw me on this, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and there's a certain, like, you know, like, you know, I forget the actual saying, I'm going to make one up, but, like, you know, trust them and keep your powder dry. Like, there's a certain, like, you know, be ready if they're going to betray you. But but that the putting the weapon down first really mattered. Let's just quickly talk about the last part that we kind of alluded to, because it's a great segue into Luca. On this podcast, another time, especially during LGBT Pride Month, just a few weeks ago, I talked a lot about the importance of representation and the differences between queer coding versus queer baiting and versus explicit content. This movie, I think, is another great example of a way to do that well, because there's nothing explicit about the sexuality of either of the characters. You know, they have a lot, they develop a chemistry, to be sure. You know, when I watched the movie the first time, like, and the first time Namiria comes on, not Miria, what?
Namari?
I'm so bad with names. Say that again?
Namari?
Namari. You know, she has, like, a shaved head. She has, like, a buzz cut on one side.
Right.
And my partner was like, oh, okay, she's the queer girl on the show. And, like, there's nothing at all explicit about that. But there also isn't what a lot of times movies will do or TV shows will do is, like, kind of throw in a male love interest for one of them just to be like, no, I don't know what you're seeing
right,
here.
Right.
There's none of that.
No.
And Kelly Marie Tran, the actress who plays Raya, has said that she, in her understanding, the characters were definitely flirting and that she acted the part as though they were flirting.
Right.
And for a Disney movie, I mean, that to me is fantastic in terms of representation of, like, they're willing to allow the coding be out there. They didn't hit you over the head. It wasn't, you know, a kiss on screen in a Disney movie between two same-sex characters, which I'd like to get one day, but two same-gender characters. But, well, I'm not expecting that anytime soon. But just to have that level of coding and acceptance without any of the, no, that's definitely not that, I thought was really, really powerful.
Yeah, I mean, the first time that even as kids they interact, I was kind of like, like, it felt like there was some dynamic there that didn't feel exactly like just, like, they're kids, so maybe there's no sexuality to it, but it felt
like that kind of, like, puppy love, like, the kind of thing where, like, a person later looks back on is like, oh, yeah, my feelings for that friend. No wonder I'm gay. Like, yeah. You know, it's that kind of like puppy love feelings you get when you're 10 or 11.
Yeah. So that, you know, I felt like that was conveyed there. And then later on, it felt more sort of, not explicit, I guess, because it was implicit, but more obvious, more like they're older. You know, and then they're also fighting. So there's this whole like physicality to it as well. And hearing that, Kelly Marie Tran, like, put that into the role deliberately, and I think talked with them, and they kind of played around that some. You know, it feels like progress, right?
Yeah.
Like, and a lot of these things, it is like, progress is slow sometimes, and, you know, I do think there's a lot of things that I would like to see in movies that just, we don't get to see in the big budget movies, right? We don't get to see in, you know, Disney Plus shows, but we maybe get to see them in Netflix shows, and like, you know, it's just progress.
Or we get them in Disney Plus, but not on the big screen, you know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so I think, you know, I did find that to be a powerful aspect of the story, just in terms of it felt very obvious and like they weren't taking, and they weren't going to lengths to try and cover it up. At the same time, I feel like if that was like really high on the list of types of representation that I was like personally aggrieved by a lack of, I'd still be kind of like, come on, you know?
Yeah.
like, can't you just do the thing? Just do the thing. You know?
Yeah. I mean, we definitely need a Disney princess movie who gets rescued by another princess.
Right.
Like that has to happen at some point, you know? Shira showed you can do it and have like, you could have romance that isn't sexualized in any way that like, you know, 6-year-olds can watch and enjoy, and there's nothing like, you know, remotely sexual about it. It's just, you know, like if Cinderella can kiss a boy, then another princess can kiss a girl,
right,
you know,
exactly.
Or any gender or whatever,
exactly,
etc.
And like maybe in 10 or 20 years, I don't know.
Yeah, like you said, I think it's a progress thing,
yeah.
You know, and I was just really, really happy to see that. So, and so let's now get into Luca,
okay, yeah.
Because we said Luca is a story that, Here this time, I'll try to kind of get the brief summary of it.
60 seconds on the clock. Good luck.
Here again, like a lot of these stories, it is set in a... It's not a fairy... Well, it kind of is a fantasy story. There's sea monsters. But it's set in, again, a very specific time and place. And it's supposed to be like... My understanding is it references some of the legends that were kind of like talked about at the time. It's basically like 1950s, 1960s Italy. You know, think of like The Talented Mr. Ripley, you know, in that kind of setting. It's very much that. It's young men on Vespas discovering themselves and things that. Which, by the way, is a film genre laced with incredible amounts of like contextual like homoeroticism, which I don't think is coincidental in the slightest. But so in this movie, we open with a bunch of like what I would have called merpeople. You know, kind of anthropomorphic with tails. But they refer to as sea monsters in this. And they're living their lives and dealing with, like, the people up on the shore. You know, you have a Little Mermaid-type character, but he's a boy who dreams about life up on the shore. And he discovers that if he goes up on shore, he turns into an actual person.
Into a human.
Yeah, okay, sorry, yeah. Person, I mean, as human. Like, sea monster to me also is a very personified thing. But yes, no, they are both sentient beings and all that.
Yeah.
He is a human being now.
Yeah, he's got skin and legs.
Good catch. And I think at this point, he's supposed to be like 11, 12, like, and still in that same, like, prepubescent, like, not thinking in those terms, but wanting to kind of, like, have adventures and run away from home. And he meets another sea monster who's also a young boy on the land, who's basically like, look, we can, like, you know, be Peter Pan. We can run away from home. We can go have all these crazy adventures. And they get into this, you know, grand story. And again, it's a story you've seen 100 times before where they want to get money so they can buy a Vespa because the Vespa is a symbol of freedom. And they figure out that the way to win a Vespa is to compete in this great race. This is where actually my partner described is a cross between Little Mermaid and a sports anime. Which really is a whole like subgenre of anime.
To clarify, it's a triathlon of bike riding, swimming, and
pasta eating.
Ooh, I'm going to have pasta for dinner.
Yeah, so good.
So appropriate.
So, like, you know, of course, they meet a local girl who wants to help them, and they have antagonism with her, and then they all become part of the team, and there's antagonism with the family, and then the family helps them. And all the while, the main antagonist is a 16-year-old boy who's basically Gaston from Beauty and the Beast, the movie. You know, very full of himself, very much a bully, who you're not surprised at all will get found, you know, by the end, mm-hmm. everyone will have been like, oh, you're not actually that great. We're going to throw you in the fountain. And there's stories about family acceptance and things like that. And his family, our hero, Luca, the sea monsters, they come on shore because they're very worried about him, you know, trying to get him back. And all the time, there is this story happening in the town of, like, people have seen these sea monsters in the water offshore, and everyone's afraid of them, and everyone's concerned about them, and everyone wants to go hunting them. And so our heroes are very, very afraid of being exposed. And, like, if any part of them ever is hit by water, that part of them will switch.
Right.
Ranma one half, to throw in one more reference that this is pulling from. And this is where it really becomes kind of the coming out story, because it's, you know, so much about, like, do I tell people who I really am versus do I hide that? Do I challenge their fears or do I hide it? And you get this very poignant, very difficult movie where Luca's friend is exposed for who he is. And Luca basically throws him under the bus and says, like, oh, no, he's a sea monster, not me. Which, both if you've watched, like, you know, queer coming out teen stories, or just talk to, like, teenagers who went through that, is a thing that happens both in the stories and in real life a lot, where people, like, their partner gets caught, and, like, to not get in trouble, they kind of are like, no, that wasn't me, kind of a thing. And that's been done very well and very badly in some stories.
How did you feel about it in this one?
Say again?
How did you feel about it in this one, in terms of well?
Let me just finish the summary. Yeah, let's put that thing together. I'm going way too long. Apologies. So then the race happens, and of course the race happens during the rain, and, you know, shenanigans ensue, and we try to stay hidden, but in the end, Luca has this moment of, like, the only way to win the race, as well as to help his friends, is to expose himself. He does do that, and they win the race, and the parent figure, the parent of the girl, who has really gotten to know these two young boys, like, the whole town is, like, not sure what to do. Like, did they win the race? You know, are they sea monsters? Are they humans? What are they? And in kind of, like, the, you know, totally unsurprising, but still makes me feel like someone was chopping onions in the room moment, you know, they say, like, are they sea monsters or are they people? And he says, they're the winners of the race.
Right.
And it's just this wonderful moment of exposing every, you know, and then two little old ladies who are in the town, they kind of let themselves be exposed. That's their sea monsters too.
Yeah.
And it's just this wonderful, wonderful story that nothing about it will surprise you, but everything about it is charming and just a really powerful story on a lot of levels. So what did you like about it?
Let's see. I got a list. always a list. I did feel like it was a charming story, you know, that it didn't feel like it was trying to do too much. It felt like it was trying to do maybe two things at once, and I felt like it did those both really well. Which was just tell a simple story, but also have that story be an allegory, you know, for coming out. And again, like, I love the scenery. For a lot of the movie, the stakes were just, like, about a kid doing something his parents didn't want him to, you know, which is just, like, going up on the surface and not even going into the town at first, you know. And it's, like, they were just hanging out. And I could just spend a lot of time on the Italian coastline, you know.
It's both this and Raya, it's very different animation styles, but both are just incredibly. My partner and I watched this only like a couple days after we'd booked our tickets to Italy for our honeymoon. And we were just like, oh, yeah, okay, this is the right thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's like, oh, when are Lee and I going to go to Italy for our...
I mean, granted, we're not going to 1950s Italy.
That's true. You can't go there.
Yeah.
But but it's just, it's visually just stunning. It works great as an allegory, which I really appreciated, like, through the movie, kind of gradually being like, oh, okay, I see where you're going with this, you know, and it felt very powerful, but it didn't feel contrived to me.
I want to ask you about that, because I was told that it is an allegory before I watched it, so I knew to kind of look for that. I was kind of curious, like, what was that like for you about, like, discovering that?
I really enjoyed that. You know, I knew nothing about the movie I saw the picture on Disney Plus, and I just like clicked, and we just started watching it. I knew it was from Pixar. That's it. And a lot of Pixar's recent stuff I haven't enjoyed quite as much. You know, I've got a lot of thoughts on some of them, but like, it felt kind of, I really just enjoyed that the story was very simple, basically. But kind of discovering that like this, I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, you know, and I didn't feel like a vibe between the two boys the way I felt between the two girls and Raya, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that could be interpreted that way. I'm certainly not going to tell anyone not to. They are younger. Like, they're not really teenagers, I think.
I think they're like 11, 12. Yeah, they're definitely prepubescent.
Exactly. That's how it feels to me. And then there was the whole thing where then Luca's hanging out more with... I want to just grab her name, with Julia, and it's sort of like, oh, now he's spending time with the girl more. And it, I mean, it's also kind of interesting that it's like, in a way, it's like he wants to do both things, you know?
Right.
And then maybe that's a whole nother, you know, thing that is also underrepresented in fiction.
Yes,
like very so. Underrepresented. Right. But, I didn't feel like it was hitting me over the head. With the allegory, I just felt like it felt like an appropriate secondary meaning that I could get from it. But I could also just watch the story and enjoy it as it was just literally the story itself. And, you know, and I mean, I think it also functions as more than just like coming out as gay, right? I mean, it does that very clearly. But at the same time, just like coming out as anything, as yourself, as, you know, maybe being someone that people look at as different somehow, and just being like, you know, you can be accepted. Like, there are people who will love you, you know, and like find those people, and hopefully those are also people who will stick up for you and help kind of like, you know, the dad, I loved the dad character. Like he like socially pressures everybody else into being like, all right, well, we weren't really committed to hating these sea monsters, you know? Like, it's kind of like he's this big, imposing dude. And, you know, and in terms of representation, also, like, he has one arm. And he's, you know, which, of course, you know, representation for, you know, people with different limb counts, right? To quote Kim's Convenience. But he also says, when asked, he says he was born that way. Which, you know, which I think is very, at first it's like, oh, was it like a sea monster? Like, is there going to be some horrible, like.
Yeah, I was so worried it was going to be that. Yeah. But no, it's just like, that's how he always has been.
Exactly.
You know?
And it's just like, And I thought that was a beautiful just addition in terms of like, people are different and that's not just fine. It's great. And like, people should be appreciated for who we are. Right. And so it, to me, it sort of broadened kind of the circle in a way in terms of, you know, just the representation within. And there were, one of my notes is there were so many places I felt like the story could go and I wouldn't have liked it. That was one of them. But it really didn't, you know, and the moment when, Luca, you know, points at Alberto and is like, sea monster. Like, I was like, ah, like it hurt, you know? And then I was like that happens, right? Like, people do that. And then the fact that Alberto was the one who came back and was like, hey, I'm going to risk my life to come here and bring you an umbrella so you can continue. Like, it made Luca's decision have so much agency.
Yeah.
That I really appreciated that. And it was moving in terms of like Alberto being supportive of him, even though he wasn't supportive of him. Like, and not that you always have to be supportive of people who aren't supportive of you. But like sometimes there are some people who are going to do like a bad thing once and then they're going to learn from it and do better. And maybe there's some people who aren't. Right. And here it's like he was giving him another chance and then he took it. And he's like, no, I don't need the umbrella. Like, I'll be like, I'm who I am, you know, I'm just like you.
Especially because I think one of the things that they develop well in the story is that Luca and Alberto are not the same thing, in part because Luca has a lot more to lose in a way that, like,
it's true.
Not in, like, a way that, like, we should be more worried about Luca, but more that, like, Luca's a lot more pretty. Like, Alberto.
Yeah.
I keep worrying I'm saying Alberta, who lives in Vancouver. Like, you know, his father abandoned him a long time ago. He has nothing. And, like, he's not pitied, but it definitely, like, it makes Luca realize, like, that he has part of why Alberto can take those risks and can and be like, yes, this is who I am, mm-hmm. is because he's not holding on to the things that he's so afraid of losing, right. the way Luca is. And yeah, it was a moment that hit very hard. But it was, and here again, like, I think I liked Luca a little bit more, but not for this reason. It's just more of a story that resonated with me. But in this one regard, I think it did what I just said Raya didn't. Mm-hmm. It trusted its audience by making its hero, its protagonist, yeah. be the bad guy in that moment. Yeah. Like, what he did was clearly a terrible thing to do. But as you said, like, it happens in real life all the time, and it's understandable. And, you know, in the counseling work I used to do in the church, like, I did a lot of work with people who were talking about, like, you know, their queer experiences and, like, how the church had rejected them in the past and stuff like this. And many of them told stories about having, like, you know, their partner throw them under the bus like this. Many of them told stories about how they were the one who did that to their partner, you know, and they clearly they were like, I was very guilty. And then and part of it's like, you were 14. Like, you know, it wasn't right. a great thing you did, sure. but you know, it's understandable.
Yeah. Not good, but understandable. Like, that's...
Yeah, and I felt like they did such a nice job of showing that, of, like, not letting Luca off the hook and not forgiving him, mm-hmm. but also not making him, like, a horrible character who now has to be, like, now Alberto is the star and Luca has to be. Like, it was, yeah. he made a mistake, he hurt his friend, gave him a lot more grace than he maybe deserved, but he then took that grace and was like, yeah, I should do the right thing. And to me, it really hit kind of the same themes as Raya did, which talking about, like, what you said, the father of... challenging the feet, you know, like, it was again, like, here's the story we've heard, sea monsters are scary, here's the reality, yeah. they eat a lot of pasta and are good at races, right. like, they're fun, you know, and that moment, and then especially that moment of the two women sort of, like, taking off the umbrellas oh, yeah. that they could be seen as what they were, it just felt like such a sweet moment of everyone realizing, like, the facade that they all had mm-hmm. of, you know, we don't have to lie, we don't have to pretend, we don't have, lie is even too strong a word, we can trust each other,
yeah.
you know, we can see that we can be accepted and then more people can come out and then more people can be like, oh, well, you too, you know, right. like, it's just, it becomes this wonderful, like, snowball effect.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that little detail at the end with the two, like, older ladies, like, coming out and being like, oh yeah, we're from the sea too. I thought was like one of the most powerful, just little details in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and shows how, you know, I mean, one person's act of bravery can inspire another person's act of bravery, which can inspire a bunch of other people's acts of bravery. And then it's like, maybe we just have a better world then for everybody.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely true. Any other thoughts you had on Luca we wanted to get into?
No, like, I didn't have as many, like, really specific details, I think, for Luca. Mm-hmm. You know, it resonated with me, but not as much, like, specifically in terms of, like, if you were to write a movie and be like, here are the things you're going to love in a movie, like, you would write yeah. Raya, you know? And yeah. Luca, I was just like, I love this for what it is, even if it's not, like, the genre that I, like, usually
yeah.
am trying to spend my time in. But I really enjoyed spending my time in the movie and in the location and with the characters.
Yeah. I think one thing I felt really about both movies, and this is kind of, I can go back to the conversation about kids' movies, I never felt condescended to.
Yeah.
I never felt like the writer was saying, okay, because you're a kid watching this, we're going to kind of spoon feed mm-hmm. you the details, you know? With the exception of that one moment in Raya, like, it felt like both these movies, but Luca especially, but really both of them, you know, were like, hey, we're going to tell this in a way that, like, kids are going to enjoy. And yet this was the movie with a lot of fart jokes, which, you know, I rolled my eyes at. And jokes about, like, you know, kids really loving eating pasta mm-hmm. and stuff like that you're maybe not going to see in The Dark Knight.
Right.
Could feel really out of place. There's another movie I saw recently that had a very dark and gritty feel, but also some, like, family romp movie stuff
right.
I didn't love yep. that we'll be talking about tomorrow.
We'll get back to that.
No spoilers. But yeah, I just, and then that's kind of a nice where I had to kind of wrap up. Like, and I feel like what I love about both of these stories is that they use the genre, and both of them, I mean, they're very classic stories, you know, just like Raya. None of the overall plot, there's never a doubt in my mind that they're going to win this race. There's never right. a doubt in my mind that Alberta and Luca are going to forgive each other mm-hmm. and that they're going to team up with the girl who's the antagonist. There's never a doubt in my mind that the little kids who follow around the bully all the movie are eventually going to realize he's just a bully. They don't right. have to do that. And he's going to get his comeuppance in some way or another. But it was still, like, by adding those details, you know, having it be that the confrontation moment is the one of them comes out, the other throws the other under the bus, the two women coming out, the so it's just being beautifully, beautifully animated in such wonderful ways. I just loved it.
I will add a couple things. One, I did enjoy the bits of Italian throughout, just in terms of language and like recognizing most of it and enjoying that. It's hard to think about the new movie without hearing in my mind, Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes.
Yes. I didn't even make the fish connection, but I definitely like Luca to me is like Luca Brasi. Yeah. So I get that connection.
But just that being the biggest line aside from like, you know, I hope your first child is a masculine child. But yeah, this is some Godfather references there for all you. And I think it's interesting that your main issue in Raya is that you feel like they didn't trust the audience enough to make Raya look bad when the whole thing is about trust. So
yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I mean, I just really enjoyed both movies. I highly recommend them. I think, you know, you can see them for the allegorical value, but like you can also just see them for not only a good story, but just like watch the screen. I mean, yeah. I think the sound is great, but like just the picture is amazing also.
I have this kind of wonderful image in my head of like super Christian conservative parents showing their kids this movie. And maybe they think Pixar is all demon, you know, Satanists. But, like, I think a lot of, like, this movie is going to get very, very family-friendly ratings.
Yeah.
Even with folks who might be, like, you know, for racism reasons, like, not going to see Raya. I think, hopefully, even, like, a lot of Christian conservatives are still going to at least go see that.
Right.
But I love the idea of it being watched with these parents who just are completely oblivious to the coming out allegory. They're just like, this is a fun story, and it has good messages for our kids. And then 10 years later, when a kid in their high school comes out, the parents are, you know, so mad that their own kids aren't more upset about this. Like, but mom, remember Luca? Like, it's okay. Like, you know, like, I don't think that by any means is why they wrote it. Maybe that's probably not going to happen too often. But if it just happens at least once, it's going to make me so happy.
I mean, I also think that kind of speaks to bring in the circle back around. Like, that speaks to the idea of movies being for all audiences, where, you know, anyone can enjoy the movies, I think. It doesn't mean everyone will, but anyone can. And it can hit people differently based on where they're, you know, what they bring to it, what they're coming to it. And, you know, maybe on another viewing years later, I might be like, oh, I missed that, you know. Because I think there's a lot of people who watch movies and don't read a whole lot of commentary about them or aren't particularly concerned with some of the things that, you know, we talk about. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't kind of filter in, you know, to the...
Yeah.
I mean, to some extent, like, movies can be propaganda, and that can be good, right? And it can be bad sometimes. But, like, you know, getting ideas into heads, like...
6-year-old me did not have deep thoughts about fascism and empires and rebellions when I watched Luke Skywalker blow up the Death Star.
Right.
But certainly, like, when 14-year-old me started to learn about jackbooted soldiers and fascism and empire, the distaste for those things that had been instilled in me by Star Wars was, you know, carried through.
Yep.
Like, and those messages can... And that's where kind of the, like... that I think that's the flip side of the representation stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to have two characters of the same gender in a Disney or Pixar movie kiss each other. But a third of the country to half the country will refuse to watch that movie. And so also having this, I think it's, you know, it's in the same way, I will really be happy when we get a Disney movie about a disabled Disney princess, you know, who is in a wheelchair or something like that. But also having a character where, like, his not having an arm is barely ever mentioned.
Yeah.
And you're right, it could have been in a bad way. It's not. But he just is, like, there as just, some people don't have an arm. Some people don't have a leg. For context, those who are new, I don't have one of my legs. I have a prosthetic. And so it's why it's particularly important to me. It's normalizing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's helping people realize, like, because there especially, kids who saw this movie are going to, like, you know, I've definitely had experiences with people of all ages, especially kids, but really of all ages, who are sort of, like, freaked out when I take my leg off.
Right.
They're like, oh, that's so weird and different. I guarantee you, there are going to be kids who meet their, you know, the first amputee friend in high school and are like, oh, yeah, like Julia's dad, you know, like it helps to normalize it. And that's, to me, that's one more way, and like the representation matters so much.
Yeah, for sure. Like, he exists and he's a character who matters, and so like just he exists and is lovable, and you know, I do think that that affects sort of just the kind of unconscious feelings that people have, you know.
Yeah. And I'll say one other thing that this kind of reminds me of is that, because here's again a way that the movie could have been terrible, but wasn't. Luca's parents are good people who care about their son.
Right.
Like, they're overprotective, and they have a lot of mythology about what the surface is like, and a lot of fear of, like, you know, don't play on the other side of the tracks, you'll get in trouble.
Yeah.
But it is clear, even when they come, they're not sort of, like, angry that he's learning all these terrible ideas. They're just concerned about him. And when they see him watch the race, they're very proud of him.
Mm-hmm.
And they are also able to be like, okay, we were afraid of the surface people, but maybe it's not so scary. And they find a way for everyone to kind of coexist in both worlds. And
yeah, for sure. For sure. Their concerns are valid and understandable, but at the same time, you know, they're, you know, maybe being overprotective. And then when they see the reality of the situation, they're like, okay, you know, we accept this. And, you know, it comes to a pleasant conclusion that sort of models like maybe that's how things can be, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I do like gritty stories. I do like stories like, you know, that show that the world isn't always happy endings and stuff.
Sure.
But like, stories with happy endings are also good.
Exactly.
You know, like, I want a story that tells me how bad the world can be, and I also want a story that tells me how good the world could be, you know?
Yeah, like, we can have both.
Yeah. So I think that's about where I'd wrap up. Paul, do you have any other last things, or do you want to kind of go into telling people where they can find more of your stuff?
Yeah, I just have, like, one last statement, closing statement.
Go for it.
Which is basically just that I feel like these movies demonstrate how you can make a piece of fiction with humor and weight and have protagonists of any age. And if you write a great story and execute it well, it can function to entertain people of any age and maybe even do a little bit more than that. So
yeah,
that's...
I think it's a great way to put it. And it's the, you know, I like things that have a strong message, but I also like things where it's subtle, you know, and where you, like, it just, it, these things have effects, especially in people on young people, but also people of all ages, you know, so.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you kind of pushed Raya towards me, and it wasn't you, but someone else who pushed Luca, but you've definitely helped me get a lot better sense of, like, just, you know, why to enjoy, you know, stuff that's for all ages.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad we got to have this conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad you watched them both.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I was just, do you want me to say my streaming stuff? I'm Zen Madman on Twitch.tv.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll be good
to
that.
On Twitter.
And I will say, there is one more that I know you, I think you've watched part of, I want you to finish.
I have watched part. I'm working through it, and maybe we'll do a thing on it when I finish. And you can give that recommendation if you want.
Mitchell's and the Machines is another fantastic one. It addresses a couple of the themes that we've talked about here in some very good ways. I'm not going to spoil for Paul, but definitely another, to me, another example of just like fantastic, all ages, kid movie, whatever you want to call it, with, I mean, like, biting satire of our current technological situation, if nothing else, with clear references to a couple of specific individuals who are very clearly being mocked and pilloried. But yeah, speaking of the evils and wonders of technology, Paul, where can people find your voice on different technological platforms?
Yeah, twitch.tv/ZenMadman. I actually spelled it wrong, but I didn't pronounce it wrong in my notes. And then also on Twitter, ZenMadman. You know, you can chat at me, and you can come out and hang. I generally play poker and ponder the nature of existence on Twitch.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe we'll branch out.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'm also doing some poker streaming on Twitch here. My Twitch channel is The Ethical Panda. Paul, what is the schedule they can find you at?
Oh, I don't know.
Or you're still kind of up in the air.
I'm kind of revamping my schedule. I most frequently stream at 10 a.m. Pacific time and at 2 p.m. Pacific time. And I'm kind of playing around with different days. For a while, I was doing every single day. I might start taking a day or two off, like every week or month or so. But
it's not the worst idea in the world.
Yeah, it has some upsides.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm doing, and what I'm doing is a thing where, like, I'm playing poker, but I'm also talking about these issues. Sometimes Paul might join me. All of mine is under The Ethical Panda. I generally stream at Tuesdays and Thursdays at 1 o'clock. And then on Sundays, I'm going to try and do this thing fairly regularly of record an episode at 8 and then go into my own poker stream at 9:30. So I will be doing that in about 15 minutes or so for those of you who are watching on Twitch. And then Paul and I are talking, Paul has been very much my mentor while I'm learning poker. So often when I'm doing the stuff Tuesdays and Thursdays, sorry, all of my times are central, panda time, at 1 o'clock central, 11 o'clock Pacific, Paul and I may will do like a hand review where it's specifically about poker, either on his channel or mine. We're still discussing that. But, you know, subscribe to both our channels, follow all that. And I would love to hear your thoughts. You know, tell us what you thought about these two movies. Tell us, you know, what you thought of our discussion, what you agreed with, what you didn't like. What are other things that are kids' movies that you think are really powerful and you still love as an adult today? And either you still love them because you love, like, getting to feel like a kid or because you don't think they're kids' movies. Let us know. You can email me at theethicalpanda@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter or Facebook, also at theethicalpanda. And if you go to my website, theethicalpanda.com, you'll find all my contact information as well as this and my other podcast, Star Wars Universe Podcast. We're doing episodes about The Bad Batch, different movies. We're going to start a book club back up again pretty soon. A lot of great things going on. All these podcasts are part of the Stranded Panda Podcast Network, which is a great network where you can find content on. There you can find content on so many different great parts of like the geeky world, MCU, Star Wars, Star Trek. We're covering like a lot of the shows that kind of don't fit in something exactly, but like they just did a whole thing on Fast and the Furious movies. Animation Deliberation does all sorts of great stuff. They just did a whole thing on Young Justice seasons 1 and 2. There's some great episodes. Check all those things out by going to strandedpanda.com. So on behalf of myself, Paul, everyone else involved, thank you all so much and have a great day.
Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes.
I don't know. And we're out.
So stanco.